From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take. As we mentioned earlier, it is Giving Tuesday, a day that encourages people to give back in whatever ways they can. And our next guest certainly has some thoughts on that, especially when it comes to social philanthropy. Let's bring in Soraya Alexander.
COO of GoFundMe. You know it as a crowdfunding platform. Also the president of Classy. Soraya joins us via Zoom from San Diego this afternoon. Soraya, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It is Giving Tuesday. And just give us an idea of what that means across the platform, because I don't actually see GoFundMe as seasonal by any means.
It's absolutely not. You're exactly right. GoFundMe actually is much more around individual needs. And as we know, those happen kind of any time throughout the year. It's much more on the Classy side. You mentioned that that division actually focuses only on nonprofits. And so several thousand customers of all sizes. And it's a huge, huge day for the nonprofit sector specifically. We see, 10 times the volume of an average day on this day alone. And it's a huge avenue to acquire new donors. So it's a big day for the sector and for what it means for their programming for the year to come.
You're a busy person, chief operating officer at GoFundMe, president of the online giving platform Classy. They have raised about $4 billion for social causes. I think some $17 billion on GoFundMe. What are the interesting things that we are seeing, Soraya, when it comes to people giving back, helping out others, helping different causes? And I do wonder if you're seeing any signs in the giving trends that show that maybe there's some nervousness about the economy. And so maybe some of that funding, if you will, or giving back is slowing down.
It's something that we are talking about a lot and paying attention to a lot. The really fascinating thing that we are seeing from our donors, and we do quite a bit of analysis across platforms in terms of giving behavior, but we also do a lot of surveys with the general public to get their sentiment. And the thing that we're finding is, yes, people are very pessimistic about the economy. They are very worried about their own financial situation. And yet, when they are thinking about how to categorize their spend and where to pull back, where to delay, where to downgrade from, let's say, brand names to generic brands, they're actually categorizing giving as a critical spend item. So they are seeing increasing need in their own lives and increasing need in society, and they're actually leaning into that. And so despite this pessimism and this nervousness, maybe because of it, people are actually declaring that they're going to give more, and they're really leaning into that. So we have seen really strong giving trends over time. And we actually saw this when COVID hit as well. The sentiment across the country was one of immense unease. And yet we saw charitable giving really spike through that time because people said, I know kind of the situation that my community is in, and I think I can respond to that need. So it's been really fascinating. There are some changes that we're seeing the last few seasons that I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because I'm curious in the changing way that people think about this stuff. And I'm also curious about and I don't mean to ask this question in like a way of, how to game the system. But I got to tell you, sometimes I'll see a GoFundMe that is just totally going viral. They've raised so much beyond what their goals are. And then I see others, that my friends post on Instagram, for example, and they're having trouble raising over $1,000.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. The GoFundMe kind of platform is really, it's we kind of help everybody become a fundraiser in their times of need, or whenever people feel like they've got an opportunity to raise for something. You know, it can be aspirational as well. We have a lot of those kinds of fundraisers who do really incredible work. But really, a lot of what we are trying to do is help people become great first-time fundraisers. Fundraising is very difficult. You have to be able to continually ask the, you know, ask people, ask your networks, go outside of your immediate friends and family, get your friends and family activated on your behalf. And some things capture the public interest in really incredible ways. And so we are constantly trying to help individual fundraisers navigate that kind of complicated landscape. And some do it really well. And for those who don't, we're constantly trying to figure out how we can better support them. But we also take a lot of lessons, again, from the classy side, which supports nonprofits. And one of the things that we are seeing is people think about giving in all of these non-traditional ways. And so when we think charitable giving, you think of the nonprofit sector. And historically, especially in America, people are incredibly generous, but through these very formal giving structures and formal institutions in the nonprofit space. And as time goes on and people have, you know, financial challenges, and yet they want to give more, they're finding different avenues where they can really connect. And that might be non-financial giving. It's often giving to individuals, not traditional nonprofits. It's giving kind of time, attention, their own platforms as an elevation point. And so we're seeing this expanded definition of giving, but then we're also seeing these incredible links where the GoFundMe platforms, these individual acute moments for giving can actually translate to long-term sustaining relationships for nonprofits. So that link has been really interesting to watch and actually help build out as well.
Well, yeah. So great to check in with you, and so appropriate, as we said, on this Giving Tuesday. Soraya Alexander, CEO of GoFundMe, president of Classy, joining us via Zoom from San Diego.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Goodwill Industries, you know them well, and I feel especially at this time of the year when you might be making some end-of-year donations. Goodwill, though, is busy throughout the year, last year alone serving nearly 2 million individuals around the globe, including helping to train more than nearly 125,000 individuals for careers in industries such as banking, IT, and healthcare. So a really appropriate guest and topic on this Giving Tuesday.
We've got Steve Preston with us. He's CEO of Goodwill Industries International. He's also got a great background. He worked in the government as administrator of the SBA. He was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Stephen, good to have you with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be with you guys.
Before we get to what exactly you're doing at Goodwill, I just want to get an idea of what you're seeing with the labor market, what you're seeing across the economy, because that is directly impacts what you do at Goodwill. So what's your read?
Yeah, for sure it does. So our network employs 120,000 people. And as you mentioned, we support 2 million people on their quest to a better job each year. So we touch the labor market in a number of different ways. We're seeing what a lot of you all see. It is hot. It's a little bit less hot than it was a few months ago, but it's still on it from a historical perspective. Really strong labor market. The other thing we're seeing, though, is the narrative here is less about the problem getting a job. The narrative is more around people being able to find the right kind of job and employers finding the right kind of employee. Increasingly, what employers have told us over the last, you know, 5 or 6 months is they've got these great jobs available, but they need people with the right kind of training to be able to be successful in them. And they're often jobs that are well-paying, offer good advancement and good benefits. We have people on the other side who are sort of churning in low-wage jobs who told us that they want those better jobs, but they're not able to compete for them because they lack the skills or other support they need to be successful in them. And so we try to provide that bridge, but there's a huge opportunity out there right now in our market for people to move from lower wage jobs into better jobs if they can get support during that pathway.
You know, Steve, I've got to say, I feel like over the years, we've talked often about a skills gap. I feel like Alan Greenspan used to talk about it a lot when he was Fed chair. And so not a new idea, but I appreciate what you're saying. So how do we really significantly make sure that, you know, the skills that are needed are being provided, whether it's through academic institutions or other types of training, you know, facilities? How do we like fix this problem that's been around for a while?
Yeah, it's been around and it's expanded and it's getting worse. So I'm glad you brought that up. I think foundationally, we need to make sure that young people are entering the labor force with foundational skills, whether they be digital skills, core mathematics, core, you know, reading and writing skills. A lot of those are missing at the outset. And that's sort of the entry point.
But is that basic education, like through high school, are you talking about?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's basic education in high school. And we need to make sure that our educational institutions are preparing people for the workforce. And many of us believe providing more vocational opportunities for people who don't necessarily want to go to college, but are perfect candidates for great jobs in the trades or in other areas. When people get older, if they're unable to be successful in the labor market, or if they have other challenges in life, it is really hard for people to get back on track. And as a result, we need ways for those people to get the support they need so that they can not only break through barriers that they have in life in general, but they can get those core skills. Hmm. We see single moms with kids in homeless shelters going to jobs at Google and Accenture in six
wow.
months.
Wow.
Because they're getting support they need to kind of work through that journey, maybe right. housing support or other support, and they're getting breakthrough digital skills or other skills. And the interesting thing about that is that first job isn't necessarily the ending point. It's like a destination where people say, oh my gosh, like I can do this. I've got these skills. And it changes the trajectory for people in their lives. So there are pathways. We see it every day in the work, what we do, but we need people to get more access to those supports and not only the skills themselves, but help through that initial part of the journey so that they can get to the other end and move into employment.
Hey, Mike, we only got a minute left, but you worked in government for many years. You were former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. You were administrator of the SBA. Given what you know now, from your work at Goodwill, if you could wave a magic wand and get lawmakers to do something to help alleviate the issues that you see each and every day, what would it be?
Well, first of all, my magic wand would say, let's agree there's a problem together. And we want to work together rather than going into our separate camps. So that's a broader narrative. I think we need to focus on the core educational lack in this entire system, both at the secondary education level and beyond, because our employers need it, our people need it, our communities need it, and there are pathways both early on and throughout life that we can support that will change this issue. And I think there's a lot of data out there. There are a lot of service providers like us out there. And if we can come together, we can make a huge dent in this issue.
Well, we've run out of time, Steve, but I hope you will come back because we would love to continue the conversation. And I feel like there's a lot of other areas that we could go with you. Steve Preston, Chief Executive Officer, Goodwill Industries International. He's former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and Administrator of the U.S. Small Business Administration. He served during the George W. Bush administration. So great to catch up with him via Zoom in Washington, D.C. A lot of relevant, you know, when you look at our labor market and how tight it is, this is ways of creating workers that have the skills that are needed. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest, involved in the crypto space, blockchain and decentralized tech sector, he's an entrepreneur focused on the data digital economy, which, according to estimates, the digital economy accounted for 9% of current dollar GDP. That was 2018. That was some data points I came across. A lot and growing, Tim, no doubt about it.
We've got Michael Luckhoo with us, the co-founder of Cirrus Foundation, who joins us this afternoon from Miami. Michael, good to have you with us this afternoon. I got to tell you, Carol and I were chatting before the program as we were doing research into our guests as we do each and every day. And I went to the Cirrus Foundation's website, and I got to tell you, I'm a little confused about what you are working on. So break it down for us and for our investing audience. Explain what it is.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I want to really break this down as simple as possible for our guests. And Cirrus Foundation, what are we? So we're a technology-based company powered by Web3 to enable people to take ownership of their data, which we think is their largest digital asset, and allow you, the creator of this data, to be paid from it and to enter new financial opportunities. So, you know, the reality is everything we do online is marked with value. So you're tied into all these platforms, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, and so forth, and that is a well of data. And all of that data is being pumped into advertising, into marketplaces. It's really a trillion-dollar industry. The big problem with this, though, is that we're leaving the creator, which is you and I, out of the equation. And so we're basically flipping the switch on that to bring people back into the equation and have them earn from their one of their most prized assets, which is data.
Okay, that's, listen, that's really if I got paid to be on Twitter, my friend, I would be a wealthy man, okay? Because I spend way too much time on that platform, much to the detriment of like my thumbs, which hurt as a result of scrolling on my phone. The problem that I see, or the challenge rather, that I see with this, Michael, is you need the platforms to participate, don't you?
No, not necessarily. You know, on those platforms, they're already connecting and getting all that type of rich data. But everything you do online really forms a identity of who you are, a digital proxy of you. So as long as you're surfing the web, you're leaving bits of this sort of like digital footprint everywhere you go. So that is rich data. And that is rich data that really, in fact, you haven't really been a part of that value equation from. And so we're seeing a shift towards these abilities for brands to get a little bit more insight, which is called zero party data, and moving away from these cookie tracking softwares. But at the end of the day, regardless of the platform, you should be able to access that because it is, in fact, your data.
I feel like we're talking a little bit in the abstract. So give me an example. Like, I'm curious, Michael, how many people are on your platforms? How many people are making money off of their own data, whether it's past browsing history, whether it's current browsing history, whether it's location details? Give us some numbers.
Yeah, we're actually getting ready to launch. We've been testing a lot of this for the past year and a half. We had an early set of users, around 25,000 users on our platform, and we were able to test and see what the value is. The great part is because it's such direct insight of what the actual user is doing across the internet scape. Earmark is around $9 to $10 a month in this rich party data, but it goes further than that. The idea is that this asset is much more rich across the internet scape of what you do, but in emerging markets, that goes a long way. So in a household, that's five people, it could be up to $45 a month, and that pays for a lot of bills. You know, it's a surprising stat, even in the U.S. alone, that around 47% of people are not even able to come up with an emergency bill of $500. So every dollar counts, especially in the economy this day and age. So that's really what we're intending to do, and unlock a digital asset that already exists for and put it back into your pocket.
Who's paying for it? So give me an example of who would ultimately pay to have my data or Tim's data or somebody from an emerging market.
Yeah, there's massive data market platforms out there. It's a bid and ask kind of marketplace right now, of which these marketers tie into. So ad revenue platforms tie into this, and brands buy this data. So they say, okay, I'm looking for this subset of users, whether it's this profile, this demographic, and they were able to bid on this. Live bidding actually happens. So this all happens behind the scenes, and people don't really know it's actually happening. So big advertising agencies and brands are actually buying this every day, every single day we're actually on the internet. And even more so now because they're so much more connected to the internet. So this is actually already happening. We're just tying ourselves into that equation. It's really a massive well of value. So That's the only thing. The people who have created the data have been left out.
Hey, Michael, one thing that we found over the last few weeks and indeed months since the fall of Three Arrows Capital is the way that so many firms in Web3, and I'm using that term as a broad umbrella term, are so tied together in a way that we didn't know they were tied together. We saw this with the implosion of FTX as well and the bankruptcies that have occurred since then. Do you at Sirius Foundation have any exposure to FTX, Three Arrows Capital, or any of the projects or companies that have gone belly up?
Yeah, no, not at all. And this is what, you know, it's really challenging me. I've been in this industry for so quite some time. And the philosophy around Web3 and is around owning your data and owning your assets. So we had no exposure to this. This is, in fact, was a Web2 type of centralized company that had misappropriated people's funds and their assets. And that's gone completely against the grain of
You're talking about FTX?
Correct.
And we should note that, you know, this hasn't been proven yet in any courts of law, but they have filed for bankruptcy.
Correct. Yes. And you know, the court findings will find what happens from this. But our philosophy is that these things would have been safeguarded in any event, because Web3 is around owning your assets and owning your data. And so that's a decentralized mindset. You know, some of the examples such as decentralized finance or Bitcoin really stand for that. We've had no exposure from that. And I think if people really lean into what Web3 really stands for, the charge is about owning your assets. And so we don't want to see bad actors come into the space and take advantage of the narrative. You know?
Michael, what's the stop of Google or an Amazon saying, okay, I get it. Your data is your data. We'll throw you something. But we still want to be an aggregator of lots and lots of data. Just got about 30 seconds. So basically doing what you're doing, some of the existing entities that are out there, like I said, whether it's Google, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's Amazon or others.
Yeah, the reality is they've been built on big data. That's their business model. And I would find it very difficult to see that they're going to shift away from that completely. They've been built on the tops of personal information and data. And to completely take them away from what their core business model has been built on, I find that hard to believe. I think the idea is, as we shift to more of a progressive digital economy, which is Web3, that large companies such as Facebook, Amazon, Google will have to compete for access to our data. And that's really the redefining how we use the internet. This is not something that's going to happen early. I think there'll be early adopters first, and then there'll be the kind of the unwilling followers.
Well, ownership of data is certainly a big thing and a big topic, and something governments are increasingly concerned about and looking into. Michael Luckow, thank you. Co-founder of Sirius Foundation, joining us from Miami.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session, counting down to the closing bell on this Tuesday. So let's talk about the markets before we head over to our TV colleagues to bring you down to the close. David Dietz is back with us.
He's managing principal and senior investment strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. They've got about $9.3 billion in assets under management. David joining us once again on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. David, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
Yeah, good to have you back with us. Hey, Carol and I were focusing on the slew of economic data that we're going to get this week. We're getting non-farm payrolls on Friday. We got JOLTS data on Wednesday. We're going to hear from Jay Powell tomorrow. What's front and center for you?
For me, it's Jay Powell speaking tomorrow. The title of his talk is going to be The Economy and Labor Markets. And the setup here reminds me a lot of just before Jackson Hole, where you know the market has had a nice stretch here since October. We're up at close to 12%. And, you know, Don't fight the Fed. The Fed is annoyed. Jay Powell's going to be annoyed because he's working so hard to try and get inflation down. And when risk assets start to rise, people start to spend. And that kind of defeats what his game plan really is. And so here, all bets now are on 50 basis points in December, but he may use tomorrow's talk to talk down, jawbone down that market and get people a little bit nervous. So it's a two-way street here on the stock market.
When you look at valuations, David, when it comes to the equity side of things, what are they priced for? Are they priced for a shallow recession? Are they priced for a deeper recession? Are they priced for what at this point?
Yeah, I think at best it's a shallow recession or not much of a recession. I mean, the good news, Carol, is we are down significantly in terms of the price-to-earnings ratio. It was around 23 at the start of the year. We got down to maybe a 15 handle, but since then we've drifted up to 17. So that's still much better than the start of the year. Here's the problem, Carol. We've got interest rates at 3.7% in the 10-year. A lot of corporates are yielding with a 5 handle. So your margin between your stock valuations and what you can get in the bond market, that isn't so juicy. And if earnings start to fade a little bit as the economy starts to weaken going into 2023, that's going to be a real headwind on the markets.
Hey, David, I think I've asked you this before, but it's been a couple months since I got to speak with you. As we think about the tumultuous and turbulent 2022 and what's ahead for 2023, at least for the equity market, is the worst behind us?
Yeah, well, trying to call a bottom is really a mugged game. Certainly in a lot of sectors, you got to believe that the risk reward is in your favor. Some of the semiconductor names, some of the technology names, they're down. Well, for example, Facebook, Meta, has lost $800 billion in market cap. Could it get worse? Of course it could, but it seems to me we're closer to the bottom than anything else. Different sectors of the market drop at different times. You've got over in China where the news is all bad, but nevertheless, large cap tech is up about 33% since October.
So David, you mentioned Meta. So buy Meta?
As part of a well-diversified portfolio, I love Meta. I mean, it's a unique property. They're reaching 2.5 billion consumers on the planet every month with, the Instagram and the Facebook and the Reels and the WhatsApp. And this is after they're down $800 billion market cap. So a value guy such as myself can finally buy it. It's 10 times free cash flow, trading at 13 times next year's earnings, very little debt. Now, the big problem is they're spending big bucks in the Meta.
Right.
First of all, I think longer term that will be successful, but they could always dial that.
What's back. Longer term, already, though? Like, are you saying that this could be a 10-year play before Meta really pays off, in terms of its banking on the metaverse?
So the fun thing about stock investing is stock investors bid things up as soon as they see a better stretch of road ahead. They don't wait till the end of the highway. And so I think as Zuckerberg dials back the spending on Meta, plus a combination just a little bit more of what this could ultimately do, I think investors will bring it back. I mean, this is a company that's down about 60% just in the last year. So it just has to get up 20% to make a worthwhile investment allocation.
Okay, David, give us some other names that you're bullish on.
I like Disney. Again, we're looking for world-class companies. They're down by.
Did you like Disney before Iger came back?
Quite frankly, I was disappointed with JPAC. I don't think he focused enough on the profitability. He did a great job in terms of acquiring more subscribers. They're now number one. They've surpassed Netflix in terms of these streaming subscribers. But the fact of the matter is Wall Street is in a different world now. Higher interest rates, they demand profitability now. He couldn't seem to put lipstick on that situation. I think Bob Iger is going to get with the program. He also has a way of keeping Wall
Street.
But
Bob's not necessarily backing away from streaming, so it's still the same. Of course, he may do it obviously differently. They're different leaders. I mean, did you like Disney under Chapek when you were recommending it?
We're value players. So when it got to about 190 or 200, I said, no way. Once it drops below 100, I say there's going to be a catalyst somewhere which can take it back up. They've got the theme parks. They've got the number one position to stream. They've got the world-class content. What's going to be the catalyst? I think Bob Iger coming back can get that done.
How much time do you give Iger? He's got a 2-year contract. I agree. Many would argue an incredible CEO based on what he did at the company and the performance. Investors seem to be pretty happy for a long time under his reign. How much time do you think it'll take to kind of right this ship? Especially in a world where I get the streaming play, but it's getting really crowded.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, 2 years is a long time in this business. Actually, the one thing that's not spoken enough is that what he's got to get right, which he didn't get before, is getting a successor groom. Because you're right, he's not going to be there forever. He's got only that 2-year contract. So if he can get it on the right path, plus groom someone to take over, I think Wall Street's going to be really happy. And you can see that stock return to where it was, close to 200 over the next 5 years.
All right, before we let you go, 1 minute, 30 seconds, Amazon, make your case, down 50% from July highs of last year.
Well, you know, e-commerce is here to stay. You know, we saw on Black Friday that, oh, yeah, record retail sales is up like 3%. How does that compare to inflation? Not well. But when you look at the e-commerce side of things, it's still going up double digit. Now, who's number one in e-commerce? That's Amazon, of course. And, of course, cloud. You know, they're so far beyond their nearest competitor, Microsoft. And, you know, the migration is just in the early innings there. So they got those two great businesses. Then, of course, they've got the subscription services, for example, Kindle, right. Music, video, Amazon Prime. I think it's number one in everything they do. And okay. As you just pointed out, you're buying it well off its highs.
All right, David Dietz, thank you so much over at PPAC Private Wealth Management on the phone from Summit, New Jersey.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.